Those are the words that first greeted me on February 5th of this year on my first Sunday standing here in front of you, and it's turned out to be true. In the weeks since, I've learned that you're very authentic about your welcoming, whoever we are. And this is a time people have come together in church. Now it's Sunday mornings. It has been for a few hundred years. The reasons it must be as old as our human culture. We come together to ask questions, to find answers, to love each other, find a safe place. I'm Reverend Anya. I'm joined today by commissioned lay minister, Reverend Christy Anderson, music director, Hal Walker. While we light our chalice this morning, these words from Albert Einstein. Indeed, it is not intellect, but intuition which advances humanity. Intuition tells man his purpose in this life.
Stand still after that.
Thank you.
Unitarian Universalism has been influenced by wisdom and spirituality from many sources. One tradition that has strongly influenced our faith formation is humanism and its emphasis on reason and science. This is evident in our congregation. About 6 years ago, we conducted a theological survey of congregation members The respondents were asked to choose two theological labels that describe themselves. Almost 60% of the congregation at that time chose humanism along with another label. Interestingly, Unitarian Universalism has also been influenced by a perspective that almost seems to be in tension with our embrace of rational thinking. Some early New England Unitarians, known as Transcendentalists, espoused the importance of experience, a knowing that arises from within, that is more than informative, it's transformational. As Unitarian Universalists, many of us may find ourselves wrestling with these two forces when seeking meaning. On the one hand, visible, impartial reason, and on the other hand, the inexplicable voice of intuition. Today, we lift up the perspective echoed in these words by Emerson. None of us will ever accomplish anything excellent or commanding except when he listens to this whisper, which is heard by him alone. How do you respond to the whisper nudging at your consciousness? Come, let us explore, grow, and worship together.
I brought a friend with me this morning. This is my aunt. My aunt came to visit and only talks to me. But, you know, aunts aren't very loud. They don't make a lot of noise. Sometimes aunt comes up on my shoulder and just tells me stories. And I have a very old story, because aunts pass stories on to each other. Did you know that? They mostly live underground, and down there they have like story dens or something. They talk to each other and they tell stories. And this one is from the beginning of time. Okay, from almost the beginning of time. It's almost that old. So I needed some language first. And it's about a day that an aunt, not this one, a much older aunt from long, long ago, got stuck in the snow. They went out, you know, on a nice day, and then it snowed, and poor little aunt, most of them are smaller than my aunt, most of them, I hope. I hope they're smaller. Aunts in Ohio are smaller than this. I can say that for sure. So aunt went out in the snow and got stuck, because aunts aren't very big, and they, you know, they kind of got frozen into the snow, and what have I done? But then the snow started to melt. The aunt started to get warm and was free from the snow and started walking around and said, how did that happen? What just happened here? Who did that? Who melted the snow for me? And the sun had come out naturally, melted the snow, and said, I did that. I'm very big. And the aunt said, well, yes, you are. You're very powerful. Why, I love the warmth I'm getting from you. It's so fabulous. And then suddenly, it started to get dark and cool again. The sun went away. And aunt, you know, this one has a big brain, you can see, a very big brain. But the aunt in this story, little tiny brain, couldn't quite figure this out. Looking at the sun goes away. It's like, how did that happen? Who did that? The cloud had moved in and blocked the sun. Said, well, I'm a cloud. I do this. I'm very strong and powerful. Why, I can conquer the sun. And just as it said that, it went whoosh. It just went away. Little aunt is kind of mystified by this. Where did it go? It seemed to dissolve into thin air. And the wind, there's a real blowhard. I did that. I am so powerful. I can blow away a cloud into thin air. Wind is bragging. And little aunt, ants are humble. Did you know that? They're humble. They are not pompous at all. And the wind was rather pompous. The aunt said, enough of that, and went walking away and left the area until the wind suddenly stopped, just completely, just bam, no more wind. Our little aunt, you notice, asked questions. Who did that? How did that happen? How did the wind stop? I kind of like it, but there's something weird about it. And the wall said, the greatest, I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest wall ever. I can stop the wind. I'm very powerful. I'm very strong. I can stop almost anything. I can stop people from crossing borders. I can stop the wind. I'm the greatest wall ever. There's never been a better wall. And I thought the wind was a blowhard. Oh my God. So the ant said, "Why, you are powerful. You must be able to stop everything. If I wanted to get over you, I don't know if I could do it." And the wall said, "Well, honestly, there is someone who can overpower me. It's a little rat. I feel it digging under me right now, that dirty rat." And the rat, sure enough, was digging under the wall and came out the other side just about then and said, "Ah, see, I may be little, but I can just sneak my way into places. I have very sharp teeth and claws. I can dig, I can bite, I can chew on things. I'm pretty awesome. I'm a rat. And you see the size of my ant? Aren't you glad I didn't bring my rat? It would be bigger than me to be in proportion." So just as the rat was bragging, a cat pounced on it and said, "Yum, I love rats." And the cat, you know how cats will prance a little bit, like, "Yeah, I'm all that. I'm all that. I got that rat." And then a tiger jumped over the wall, landed on the rat and the cat, and went, "No, actually, it's me. I'm stronger than all of this. I can eat the cat that ate the rat." Anyway, I don't want to go through that whole string of things. It goes all the way back to the sun that can melt the snow. And just as the tiger is bragging, the most awful thing happened, because by this time in history, humans existed, and they'd made a net, and they threw it over the tiger and the cat and the rat, and they're all there in the net because the humans wanted to take the tiger to the zoo, no doubt, or just take them to town. You decide what they were doing with the tiger. It wasn't nice. It wasn't kind. So our little ant, by this time, so much has happened. Little ant says, "Humans must be the pinnacle, the ultimate in intelligent design. Humans must have the most power and intelligence of anyone I've ever met." And the humans said, "Yeah, probably." And just then the earth began to tremble and shake. And if you've ever been in an earthquake, you know what that's like. The earth was moving under their feet, and it started to crack open a little bit. And the wind picked up, and a swarm of mosquitoes came and started stinging these humans, and they dropped the net. And then a voice came from that crack in the ground and said, "Hey, they're not leaving yet. I could use a hand." And from the sky came a hand. Okay, it wasn't that exactly, but it was claps of thunder. So it was claps. Give me a hand. And so the thunder and then lightning came and was striking all around the humans, and the wind and the rain, and it was just torrential. Everything, it was a huge storm of global proportions, and the people went away because they were scared, and rightly so. Well, everything calmed down, and our aunt, yeah, I got it. Our aunt took a break and just said, "Wow, look at what I've experienced today. I've learned about all of these things, and now, talking to the sky, said, you must be able to do anything." The sky said, "Oh, little aunt, yeah, I can make things, I can start things, but then they just take off on their own, and humans and animals and planets get in the way and do what they want. They just, oh, let's say they evolve." So Ant says, "Well, how do you do it? Who are you? Who are you?" That's the key question. And the voice in the sky said, "Oh, I go by many names. You get to choose. Some call me BB, BB the King. BB for Big Bang. Some call me the Big Bang. Some call me the King. Some call me the source of all. Some call me nature. Some call me God. You get to choose my name." And the ant is like, "Well, that's a big job." They said, "Don't worry. It's just for you. You can call me what you want." Ant said, "Oh, well, that's a relief. But tell me, please, who am I? Who am I, tiny little ant?" Again, much smaller than this one. tiny little ant. Who am I? How do I matter? And this voice from the sky said, you matter most of all. Because you, persistent little ant, you learn to ask questions and learn new things. And whatever name you choose to call me, I will be glad to be your friend. That's the story of the persistent little ant.
And with a special joy, it is with joy that the Board of Trustees announces the success of the Carol Gould Matching Fund Drive. We raised over $11,000 from the congregation to match Carol's $10,000 donation. Thank you to Carol and to all the generous members. These funds will aid in our goals of economic justice, community outreach, and further environmental work. Thank you, Carol and UCK. Please join me in a time of prayer. Let us lift up our hearts to the source of life and love. We've come together with concerns that weigh upon our hearts. But as people of hope, we know that in time, clarity will come. May we be blessed by a comforting spirit walking beside us as we journey along the path of discernment. May we take heart in knowing that eventually the fog will lift and the answer will be revealed. May we trust life. May we trust ourselves. Amen. I begin with a quote by Italian novelist Umberto Eco. The list is the origin of culture. What does culture want? To make infinity comprehensible. It also wants to create order. And how, as a human being, does one face infinity? How does one attempt to grasp the incomprehensible? Through lists, in their various manifestations, catalogs, collections, encyclopedias, and dictionaries. I like this quote because it gives nobility to my preoccupation with making lists. I thrive on lists. My to-do list, my to-buy list, my to-email list. A list is especially valuable when I make an important decision. In these instances, I create a list of pros and cons, and on occasion, I even give items weighted numerical value. Then I add up the results and voila, a perfectly rational decision is revealed. Lists are my source of guidance. So it comes as no surprise that when my husband Brad and I were looking for a house to buy, I made a list of preferred features. There were three categories: features that are nice but not necessary, features that are important, and those that are so important that they are deal breakers. One day I read an ad for a home for sale by owner in Twin Lakes. The ad gave almost no details. I stopped by the open house on my way home from church. I went without Brad because I had little hope that it would be suitable due to my extreme pickiness. We've been looking at homes for 18 months with no success. Although acceptable in some ways, the house lacked two of the deal-breaker features. In particular, the lack of a basement was the most significant, as it's very important that I have a place to hide from tornadoes. Although I had ruled out the house as a possibility, because I was part of a group that was being led by the owner through the property, I felt compelled to tag along for a view of the backyard. While others were admiring the beautiful view of the lake, I walked over to a small inlet that jutted into the backyard a bit. As I walked to the inlet, I heard the plop, plop of two frogs leaping into the shallow water from the edge. Frogs. Now, I don't have a particular affinity for frogs, yet that split-second serendipitous encounter triggered a powerful, warm emotion that completely washed over me. I can't even find words to explain it. All I can say is that I was tingling with bliss and excitement. I immediately called Brad and said, "You've got to come see this house." 3 hours later, we called the owner and told him we wanted to make an appointment to make an offer. This was so extraordinarily uncharacteristic of us both, especially me. We learned that an offer had already been submitted, but not yet accepted, as it included the sale of the buyer's house as a contingency. This meant that for Brad and I to purchase the house, we couldn't ask for a contingency based on the sale of my house. I would have to take the huge risk of having two mortgages until I sold my house. Signing a purchase agreement would have been a really illogical move. Unbelievably, my gut intuition hijacked my logical head. During the 9 years that we've been happily living in this house, I've often shaken my head in disbelief that I disregarded my list of pros and cons and did something that totally defied my logical mind because of a gut feeling. After that experience, I reined in my inner voice and continued my methodical approach to living. I didn't even think about the concept of intuition until several years later when I attended an interfaith seminary. Only one classmate was a fellow UU. The others were very diverse in spiritual practices, race, and nationality. But they had one common trait. They were highly intuitive. For someone like me who follows the rational path, this was culture shock. Rather than relying on their logical heads, they followed their gut instincts. They named their inner voices with words like God, Goddess, the universe, ancestral wisdom, and spirit. I'll admit that I was intrigued and envious of the trust that they had in this inner wisdom. Like my classmates, I do recognize that I have an inner voice. His name is Bob. Bob tries to flirt with me occasionally, but not very often anymore because I ignore him mostly. I'll admit that we did have that one big fling when I decided to buy the house that was totally unsuitable based on my list of priorities. But that unusual exception didn't prompt me to keep dancing with him. You see, Bob and I just don't have a relationship built on trust. And he's just so emotional. Now, I find that many people, including UUs, give 5-star ratings to their flings with their inner voices. They've even built solid relationships with their inner voices through mutual respect for raw instincts and sound reason. But for me, it's still uncomfortable to surrender to a partner who doesn't worship facts. Like Sean Spicer hiding in the bushes from reporters, I dodge my inner voice. Yet I'm intrigued. Perhaps Reverend Anya can convince me to be more open to my still small voice.
40 years ago, there was a song, 2 minutes and 2 seconds long. It's the group Queen, "We Will Rock You." I mentioned last week, it was last year, decided to be the song most likely to get stuck in your head. Had the perfect formula to be an earworm. Well, the song is persistent, but so is my aunt. And the solution to a song in your head, to this song, is essentially the same. You will rock me? Exactly how are you going to do that? Who's going to rock me? When will that happen? But here's the key. Neither I nor my aunt ask why. There's only one answer to why, and that's, well, because, And then it goes on with whatever. There's rarely anything useful in the response to why. How will you do that? When will you do that? Who are you to do that? How will I know when it's done? Is this what a rocking is? Am I rocking? Have I been rocking for 40 years? Well, maybe. But I don't attribute all of that to Queen. Our questioning diminishes the imperative. That was really quite a bold claim that we will rock you. So questioning diminishes that claim on our attention, that noise in our head, that relentless noise in our head that has, it just gets caught in there. And I also mentioned from about the same time, well, from 10 years earlier, number nine. Now, George Harrison picked that phrase, number nine, off just a random recording of voices of recording engineers. That was just an engineer's voice. But that sound, number nine, has a striking resemblance to the mantras taught in transcendental meditation. It doesn't have a particular meaning. It doesn't matter that it's the number nine. All the meaning was given to it later. The Beatles, collectively, were learning to meditate that same year. George was the most serious about it in the long range, but in that first year, they were all quite giddy and enthused about having learned to meditate in that specific style, a mantra meditation. And this is also a solution to the noise in your head. You know, behind that rising and falling number nine, there is a relentless and obnoxious cacophony of sounds. And that's just 30 more tracks of audio that John and Yoko, in a enlightened fervor, they just mixed all this together and they ran them backwards and all of that stuff and created quite a furor and quite a belligerent noise. But all through it, number nine would return. And that's exactly what meditation with a mantra is. All of the noise and all of the racket, and then that rhythm, that sound that resonates within you, number nine, you just let it return. You let it return. There's no challenge there. You just favor the mantra. It comes back. The mantra resonates. The chatter, the noise subsides. It's just that easy. Just that easy. But we have to have some way to find space for that inner voice within us, that intuition that is our theme of the day. So a sound in a rhythm you can submerge into is really useful. There are other ways to meditate. You can be guided, as we were, where the words have meanings. So you have to think about the meaning of the words. Or you can pick something meaningless, as they will teach you in assigning a smart mantra. It's just a sound. You can do other things. We also did this morning, which is essentially pay attention to your body. How's it doing right now? How does it feel to be sitting where you're sitting? And what about your feet touching the ground? Are you grounded? How does it feel? Are you sitting upright? There's stuff that can't be measured. Only you know. Only you know how much noise is in your head and how much there's a nice rhythm and a resonance in your head. Nobody can measure that for you. Nobody can measure how comfortable you are in your own body. It's an inner way of knowing. It's intuition. It's only you. Tuition is from outside. I'll tell you stuff. You'll memorize it. You've been tuited. I don't think that's a word. But tuition is, and it's not a fee for school. It is knowledge from outside. And you take it that way, and you hold it there. Facts that are independent of reason. Reason with a capital R. Emerson's reason. These facts, these statistics, these rules have no particular reason. They are a list that you can memorize. André Vauvard and Carl Jung both called this tension the anima and the animus, the intuition and the tuition. animus. It will dissect and analyze and measure. It's very logical and rational. There are rules and lists and guidelines. And suddenly another song popped into my head. Signs, signs, everywhere the signs, breaking up the scene. Yeah, that's the animus trying to control and make sense of. Animus understands. That's got to be a good thing, right? It's understanding. Here are 1,000 facts, and I can put them together in a way that makes sense. It is rational. That's got to be good. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not all there is. Anima, intuition, just seizes reality without intervention. Anima seizes reality directly. Reach out and be part of it. Anima is your soul, yourself with a capital S, your spirit, your gnosis, or frogs going plop, plop in a pond. And not the frog itself, but your reaction to the frog is the anima saying, here I am, I got it. Not going to explain it. Can't and don't have to. Can't and don't have to explain it because I know it. It's a bit different than being able to justify things and rationalize things. As in, it's exactly the opposite. That warm, tingling bliss you might feel in a moment when suddenly you have an answer to something. You can't rationalize that, and it can't be measured. It can't be quantified. You have to know. Now, I've made lists. I know how to make lists. I know how to lose lists. I know how to forget where the lists are. But once in a while, it's a big, important list. It's the pros and cons. I was taught to do that. Your pros and your cons and your consequences and kind of add them all up. And I was even taught, like poor Christy, to assign numerical values to different things on the list and try to make a decision mathematically, rationally. And the most prominent one, well, the most recent one was deciding to come here. Which actually happened last November. It was a choice, here or here. And I tried to do some of the pros and cons and some of the rational stuff, but you know, you don't have enough information to do that with any kind of wisdom or assurance. You have to say to yourself, tell me something I can't understand from these things people sent me. I can't understand from a website. Where should I go? Well, I'm here. I didn't really obsess about that list. Years ago, when I was still in seminary, I needed a car. And I was very low on money, of course. Needed a used car. I was in Berkeley, California. Things are expensive. I started trying to be very rational about how to do this. And for weeks, because I'm very patient, I'm very stubborn, I made lists of pros and cons to help me determine what kind of car, how much could I spend, and so on. And one day, I walked home from school. It was like a muggy day like this, only hotter. And mugginess is rare in Berkeley. So I was annoyed. I was uncomfortable. And I looked at the list on the fridge. And I grabbed a big marker and I just wrote, red. Because I wanted a red car. 3 days later, I found a red car. We went out to the burbs and looked at it. I instantly knew that'll work. That'll be great. And then for many years, drove that car. And it was just a happy car. You get in it and you go, yeah, I actually want to go somewhere. Instead of that sort of plodding along thing. And it was just that little boost that I needed, that my morale needed at that time of life. It was unthinkable prior to that, that I would just pick a car because I wanted red. That was not a thinkable thought. It's just not how I was raised. But there are much grander, unthinkable thoughts. My gender identity was one. It was about 12 years ago, on a particular day, it was unthinkable to me that I had a transgender identity. I was aware that certain things had caught my attention throughout my life. Christine Jorgensen and Renee Richards and everyone who was ambiguous about their gender caught my attention. And I felt odd about that. Trying to fit into doing guy stuff. Oh my God, I thought I could get it right. I thought I could figure out what guys do, but they'd always catch me. They wouldn't call me out. They'd just get uncomfortable with me and do what guys do, which is just kind of start excluding and so on. And I would go away puzzling my head, like, why can't we talk about feelings? I don't understand that. Because I thought that was progress. So on one day, all of that was unthinkable, and the next day, I knew. The mid-career counselor I saw, as I said last week, she just interrupted our second day of a 3-day assessment and said, you're not going to be happy or successful until you deal with your gender identity. You can't do, I forget Emerson's words, it was about like grand and glorious things until you listen to your inner voice. It's the same idea. She held up her hand and said that, and I simply knew instantly. The unthinkable thought became thinkable. Not only that, a list instantly appeared in my mind. And it was a list of all those moments in my life. It was a list of that had these things, like all the times I was uncomfortable in a gender role. It had the hundreds of times my first wife told me, you'll make someone a good wife someday. It was all of those things. It was the struggles. It was the moments that were inexplicably just happy and comfortable, and they had been so rare. So I started checking off the things on the list, and I've never reconciled the list so quickly. After lunch that same day, I went back to Mary McKrenna. By evening, we had a plan. Because the truth resonated. I knew I had that feeling when she said those words that caught me so off guard, like an unexpected frog plopping into the water, only bigger. Only bigger. We had a plan. It took me about a year, or took me more than a year, before I finally swallowed the blue-green pills. Emerson says in Self-Reliance, we must be nonconformists. What he's referring to is we must not be someone else. We have to be who we are. That's the essence of transcendentalism. Insist on yourself, never imitate. Yeah, you learn stuff. Those are some of the brightest minds of the century were the transcendentalists, and they knew that they could never write it all down, they could never read it all, they could never learn everything from someone else. They knew all that stuff, but they knew there was another way to access more important things. Insist on yourself, never imitate. Self-reliance isn't about making your way in the woods as a hippie in the 70s. It's about finding truth from within. Until then, you'll never be happy or successful. Understanding is good, but it blinds us to learning something new. It's finite. It limits us to what we already know or are currently learning. It limits us to rules. It limits us to lists. Reason doesn't reason. That's capital R reason, doesn't little R reason. It perceives what can't be measured. This flash of knowing that you have to buy the house, that you have to buy the car, that you have to turn this way or that way. That flash can't be tested by your animus, by your rational mind, by logic. It's a whole body mind elation that resonates within. The unthinkable becomes thinkable, and then you have a new truth in your life. So listen always and carefully. It's just this life. Be alert for a giddy bliss or its equivalent. Your wild, precious life, why not live it fully as your truest self? In that spirit, I say amen. And while you're standing and putting away books, find a human hand nearby. Reach out. See if that hand is willing to take your hand. Feel the humanity there, feel the pulse, feel the warmth and the clamminess and stuff, and remind yourself that it's always cold and flu season, and washing your hands often is the best way to avoid illness. Okay. One should always question things. We only sang the first verse of that song. The third verse was yet another typo, but with an intentional typo in the hymnal. In the office, we have one corrected by Rick Mastin, who wrote the song. And in the third verse, it says, "Bear the pain." And in the hymnal, it's B-E-A-R, "Bear the pain." Oh, you can take it. Toughen up. Rick wrote, "Bear the pain. Tear it open. Bring it out in the open. Bear the pain." Question everything, especially homonyms in our hymnal, or things that might have been switched to dumb them down or to make them politically correct or to make them all gentle and fluffy and warm, when actually life is about bearing the pain, recognizing it, not stuffing it away and being a tough guy about it. Life is about caring until you cry. Life is about loving until it hurts. Life is about risk. And you can't make rules about that. You have to listen to the voice that has no words. It's inside you. Hey, if Emerson and Margaret Fuller and the gang could do it, so can you. You're the brightest minds of this century. They were the brightest minds of their century. Listen to yourself. Let a sound resonate within you that has no meaning, so that true reason, with a capital R, can help guide you through your days. Go in peace. Amen.